From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections Healthy Friday. Our connection for this hour goes back to the first of the month when the state legislature approved the 2015 budget. The New York Medical Schools had requested $50 million to help fund faculty development in a program that would help the institutions recruit and retain high-profile entrepreneurial biomedical researchers. States like Texas are investing heavily in research and are actively seeking out the best and brightest to attract them away from other universities. Medical schools say they need lawmakers in Albany to help them invest in the most up-to-date laboratories and talented support staff so researchers can achieve their goals and help them bring in more funding through private and federal grants. And later this hour, next month, May is Mental Health Month, we'll discuss a new peer-based crisis mental health center with the directors of Affinity Place. If you'd like to join us over the phone, give us a call, 844-295-8255. 844-295-TALK. In the studio with me right now is Dr. Stephen Dewhurst. He's the Vice Dean for Research at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me, Michelle.
Over the phone, we have Jo Wiederhorn. She's the president of the Associated Medical Schools of New York, or AMNSY, or NY, sorry. Hello and welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
So, Jo, some disappointment from Albany in the state budget. What is it that happened?
Well, I think what happened was there were a lot of competing priorities. And I think part of the issue is that people don't understand the importance that bringing in star researchers into New York State would have, not only on the state's economy, but also on health outcomes for people. So it's a constant education process that we have to do with the legislators. And to continue to explain to them what's going on, why it's so important, the types of research that's being done, the down-the-road economic impact of this, and the down-the-road economic, healthcare outcomes of it. It's just a continual process, a long-term process.
Dr. Dewhurst, here in Rochester, what are some of the programs that we have right now that are being funded that we would like to have more funding for that this money would have helped us put into place?
I could think of two right off the top of my head. So I just came here from our neuroscience retreat over at the Memorial Art Gallery. And that's it's our faculty and our students in neurosciences. It's a fantastic program at the university. And we would love to have more faculty in that area. In fact, right now we're recruiting somebody to head our new Del Monte Neuromedicine Institute. And that faculty leader is going to want a lot of new faculty members as part of his program or her program, whoever we choose. And really building that program up, that requires recruitment. And it requires, as you've already said, the best and the brightest to come here. And that will draw the best students. It will also end up drawing the best trainees in our medical school. And as you know, the medical school at Rochester trains most of the community doctors who will end up staying here. So that whole ecosystem starts with the best possible faculty we can have. Another area that's a really big one for us is data science. We're really very invested in data science. If you look at the future of healthcare, it's the electronic health record. It's all of that information that's right in there available to patients, but that's a huge research opportunity. We can learn a lot about the way we deliver care and improve that care by using that as a research tool, and that's the reason fundamentally that that's a huge focus for us at the medical center and institution-wide.
You know, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, there is funding in other states. You had mentioned before we went on the air, what were the states that you had mentioned? We mentioned Texas, and we'll be hearing from the chancellor of Texas A&M. But what are other states doing?
Yeah, so we also talked briefly before we went on air about Minnesota. So Minnesota invested $30 million very recently per year in effectively a single school. It's a great school, University of Minnesota. We'd like to think we're as good as the University of Minnesota, but there's at least 7 or 8 or 9 schools in New York that are equivalent to the University of Minnesota. We'd like to see them all have that same ability to recruit great faculty. One of my jobs at the university is as a department chair, and in my department, I've had the frustration firsthand of competing against states that make this kind of investment. So I've had one faculty in my member and in my department, I lost to the state of Georgia. They made a great recruitment offer to him. I couldn't match it. Another one, we were in the process of recruiting somebody from Georgia, and Georgia again came through with a whole bunch of money, and they kept the guy. I couldn't afford to bring him into my department, and it was a huge loss.
Now, when I was speaking to the chancellor of Texas A&M, he said, you know, some of this is bonuses for signing on, but a lot of this is infrastructure in the university itself. Joe, can you explain that?
Well, when you recruit a scientist, a lot of it goes to redoing labs for them, expanding labs, buying very expensive equipment for them. And that's the infrastructure that people generally talk about when they talk about whether it's capital funds or infrastructure money. It's, most of the recruitment dollars don't go for salaries. Most of the recruitment dollars do go for these other types of equipment that are needed so that the scientist can do his work. So that's really, I think, what the chancellor was saying when he was talking about infrastructure. For instance, they recruited a scientist from Sloan Kettering, they being Texas, recruited a scientist from Sloan Kettering, James Allison. He's one of the forerunners in the immunotherapy field in terms of looking at cancers, and they recruited him with $10 million. This is a huge recruitment, but it didn't go to his salary. It also helped him bring down other people and what they needed, his lab techs, his postdocs, other salaried researchers, and helped to remodel the lab so that he could do his work down there. When people think about recruitment, they think, oh, we just want to, spend all this money for salaries for faculty, and really that's a minor part of it.
It's more the investment in the research itself. So let's hear from John Sharp. He's the chancellor of Texas A&M University System. He joined us over the phone earlier this morning. He says the university system is now ranked 19th in the nation in terms of research, but they're investing and actively recruiting to improve that ranking.
I think about a year ago, our research National Science Foundation numbers were in the neighborhood of between $600 and $700 million of research. This year, it's about $840 million of research, and much of that has to do with what has happened in our Health Science Center. But basically, what we did is we have a permanent university fund. The fund is designed for buildings, but it also has auxiliary money that can be used for other purposes. And we dedicated $150 million of that money, $100 million over the last 18 months, to recruiting something called the Chancellor's Research Initiative for recruiting National Merit Scholars and Nobel laureates to the university. So what we do is we made that $100 million available. It can be used to build laboratories to the specifications of the person that we want to recruit. It can be used to pay the person a bonus to come here. And so we've used $100 million for that. We've just added $52 million more for the next year and a half. That's for Texas A&M. And for Prairie View A&M University, part of it is. And the other universities, we give them about $10 million within the system in order to do the same thing. And what we've found is that a lot of places in the country right now are having trouble with their budgets for whatever reason. They're not able to meet the demands or the requests of some of the finest scholars and researchers in the country. And we try to meet those and try to get them here to College Station. We think it's one of the reasons that Michael Young, the president of the University of Washington, decided to come here. He starts his presidency May 1st, and as you probably know from looking at his record, he's very good and very accomplished in growing research, and that's one of our main goals at Texas A&M University. We're now according to National Science Foundation numbers, number 19 in the nation in terms of overall research.
How much is coming from the state, and how are you talking to legislators in your state to get them to invest in Texas A&M?
This money that we're talking about here is from the Permanent University Fund. That's the big endowment that Texas A&M has in West Texas with oil and gas. But at the same time, the governor has just called for the creation of the governor's research initiative, which is patterned after Texas A&M's chancellor's research initiative, and he has put several hundred million dollars behind that for all universities to share in. In other words, Texas A&M, University of Texas, Texas Tech, whoever can recruit Nobel laureates or the equivalent and go to the governor's office and ask for funds to do the same thing that we're doing with our internal money as well. And so we believe very strongly here at Texas A&M, and I think the governor certainly believes that research is an integral part of what the state is about, and especially what our universities are about, and we're going to grow it as large and as fast as we can with quality researchers.
Well, research institutions across the country are probably going to be envious of some of this investment that's coming from the state. What advice would you give to med schools in New York State who hope to be competitive in their recruitment and retention efforts?
You've got to meet the demands. I mean, the folks who are in this category and who are sought after are people who can be very mobile, and you've got to meet their demands. And if you can't, then they're going to go to those places that can provide the resources that enable them to fulfill their research hopes and dreams. And quite frankly, it takes resources. It takes money. Well, one of the things that we did on top of that is we cut our administrative costs down to 3.6%, and we sent all of the savings of that money into a fund at the president's office that he and the provost use for research and for recruitment and things like that. And so you've got to make a dedicated effort to figure out what's most important in universities. And it's generally not administrators like me. It is researchers in the lab and teachers in the classroom, and that's where we're focusing our resources.
Now, as a chancellor, you're probably speaking to legislators and talking to them about that this is an important investment that you want them to continue to make in state institutions. How does that conversation go? How do you convince them? It sounds like there's been at least a culture change, or at least that there is some culture in investing in research in the state.
No, I think, the governor, first of all, is very dedicated to it. He is in the legislation that he's promoting is moving through the legislative process. We think it's going to be successful. I think what you have to do with research is you have to show the practical effects of successful research. And we're able to do that. We have a Board of Regents at Texas A&M that is really high on making sure that we do world-class research and that we have the resources behind it, and we think they, along with, have been able to convince legislators to follow them.
That was John Sharp, Chancellor of Texas A&M University System. At the end of my conversation with the chancellor, I asked him to comment on allegations that Texas institutions are poaching the best New York researchers, and this is what he had to say.
I would ask any researcher there in New York that would like to know what's going on at Texas A&M to give us a call, and we'll let them see what we have, and if they want to come here, we welcome them.
Now, Joe Wiederhorn, this is exactly your concern.
Yes, absolutely. And Texas has poached 13 people over the past couple of years. And I just wanted to clarify one thing that he said, because initially he was talking about a fund that was for Texas A&M only. The state has put money in on top of that fund, and the state has put in over $240 million on top of the $152 million that Texas A&M has received from the oil industry. So this is our concern, as Dr. Dewhurst had said earlier, other states are looking at taking our scientists as well. Georgia, Stony Brook on the island lost one at least to Florida, New Mexico, and these small states, not only Minnesota, but Indiana, Maryland, they're states with one school, the legislature is seeing that this is something important to their, it's the new economy that is being grown up around the country. And we believe that it's time that New York continued to keep its status as one of the top states in the country.
Dr. Dewhurst, how do we convince legislators, if you're thinking that that's something that you need, that funding, and you've got lots of funding in comparison in other states like Texas, they've got oil and gas money that we don't necessarily have in New York State. How do we compete?
Yeah, so let me start, I guess, just to respond slightly on the oil money. I think it's important to remember New York State is the financial home of the nation. So, in fact, we have a lot of resources we could bring to bear. So starting with that, then, you know, my role, the reason I'm here is because we obviously haven't done as good a job as we should have done in educating the legislature, in educating people in the community, why this is really so important. And I'd point to multiple reasons why it's important. But one of the things that the A&M chancellor spoke to was, what's the science do? Why does it matter? So I think one of the important things is to sort of say, well, what's happened here in Rochester that matters? The HPV vaccine, that's the cervical cancer vaccine, was developed here in Rochester. That's the kind of thing that's possible if you have world-class scientists working at a world-class institution in this town. If you look at spin-off companies, we have spin-off companies throughout the community that are from the University of Rochester. So VaccineX, for example, on Mount Hope Avenue, that's a Rochester or a U of R spin-off company. It has on the order of 50 to 70 employees. iCardiac is a newer spin-off company. It's about the same size. It's really in more of an analytical, as the name implies, cardiac indication. There's a brand new company that I'm associated with myself. We launched it no more than a month ago, Camber Neurotherapeutics. The point I'm trying to make is that entrepreneurial faculty will start companies because it's where their science leads them. So that's a huge piece of it. And then the other huge piece of it is it allows us to bring in the best and the brightest in our students, our trainees, our clinicians. It's all one big ecosystem. And the last point I'd really want to emphasize is that the universities can't move. We're the University of Rochester. We're not the University of Minnesota. We're not the University of Stony Brook. We're here permanently. So an investment in the University of Rochester is an investment in this community.
Well, and it's also the largest employer in the state, in the community.
That's correct. So that's the other point that again, we need to really make clearer. So the university employs about 22,000 people in this community. It, as you say, it's the largest employer. It's an enterprise that's on the order of $2 to $2.5 billion a year in annual overall revenues. But within that larger structure, the research piece is about one-fifth of the whole. So that's to say it's on the order of $400 million of external research funding every year, and it's on the order of about 4,000 people who work in that area. So it's really a very large economic driver. If it were a company on its own, as a standalone company, it would be one of the largest companies in Rochester.
Go ahead, yes.
Yeah, so there were just a couple of things that I wanted to add on, you know, granted, this show is in Rochester, and Dr. Dewhurst is from Rochester, but spinoffs are happening all over the state. Stony Brook has spinoffs here in the city. There are a number of schools that have spinoffs, and what's happening is that, you know, this is where the governor, to get back to the legislature and the governor, this is where the governor is putting money, and it's a very important piece of what basic science and what investing in science is all about. It's the spin-offs and it's the patents and the license and new therapeutics, ultimately. I mean, that's really the bottom line. It's new therapeutics. But what we're not investing in is the part that's the very first step, which is the basic science. You can't get to the spin-offs and you can't get to the additional companies that are going to bring in high-paying jobs until you get to the very first thing, which is the scientist who's going to make the discovery. And by the way, the scientist brings in people, and in the bioscience sector, these are high-paid jobs that people come to. They come to universities, they get benefits. These are not box store jobs, and people come and they're committed and they stay here. And as Dr. Dewhurst said, they really do help revitalize the economy. But The other piece of all of this is clinical trials, because nobody really talks very much about clinical trials. There have been a number of shows on PBS and on HBO about what's happening in terms of new types of treatments, immunotherapy, personalized medicine. Well, you can't get any of these out to the public as a whole unless you do clinical trials. And the clinical trials are done in places where the discoveries are made. So the chancellor was saying that Texas is number 19 in the nation in terms of funding, federal funding. Well, New York is number 3. And if you look at the number of clinical trials that are done here in New York versus the number that are done in Texas, it's flat. We basically do the same number of federally funded clinical trials as Texas does. But every time we lose a scientist, there goes that potential for a clinical trial. And we're losing top seed scientists. So they're the ones that are more than likely going to be the ones who are going to do the clinical trials. And clinical trials bring new therapeutics, new treatments to the community. Plus, they bring in people from all over the country who, you know, want to come and want to try this because they've lost hope everyplace else. So I think we can't forget in the economic, definitely economic driver, but it's also, you know, a way that people can look at new treatments for their own health care.
Now, you mentioned New York being third in the nation. Are we at risk of slipping in that ranking?
Oh, absolutely, because the scientists that Texas is recruiting, Florida, California are recruiting, these scientists have NIH grants. And the way NIH grants works is if I'm at Medical School A and I have a $2 million NIH grant and I'm recruited to Texas, I take my grant with me. So we lose our funding for that grant. The jobs go, the money goes with that. And that grant is, and the person who gets that grant has the potential for getting more grants and bringing in people who'll be getting more grants. So every time we lose a scientist, our brain trust is being depleted.
Dr. Dewhurst, are we at risk of losing certain grants or not being as competitive for NIH grants or other grants at the University of Rochester?
We definitely would be. There are many instances of where you can have a complicated grant proposal that you're putting together that really requires a lot of different kinds of expertise, and you need those people in-house. You know, for example, I'd mentioned data science previously. There's a lot of areas in data science where you need particular kinds of expertise or skills, and they're not easy commodities to find. So you really want those people in-house. You want to be able to talk to them as you develop your ideas, as you put together what will be a grant proposal. They have to be part of the team. The same is true in almost any other scientific discipline you want. The better your colleagues, the better the proposal you'll put together. And more to the point, the better the science you'll do. And in the end, the more important impact you'll have on human health about developing better cures or better treatments, things that make a difference in people's lives.
If we loop back to infrastructure, are there things that you feel that we should have in laboratories for research scientists at URMC that we don't have? Or is this just a matter of keeping up as the very fast pace of change in laboratory science?
Well, it's largely a matter of keeping up. It's largely a matter of being able to bring in the best and the brightest. So it's not just keeping up. Nobody gets that excited about keeping up, frankly. So what people get excited about is something new that you can do, something where you bring in somebody who's that key missing piece, who then means you can really assemble this team around that one person, or they're the last piece in what would otherwise be a team. That's really where it makes a huge difference. It allows everybody else to raise their game because you brought somebody in with a new skill. You know, in my own department, we hired somebody a couple of years ago, quite recently, who works on the microbiome. And that was a huge deal for everybody who works around him because he's really the expert in that area for us. He's a go-to guy that everybody will go talk to so they can do clinical studies in premature children to understand what the impact of the microbiome is on their development and their health. So it that kind of recruit makes an enormous difference.
Part of my conversation and some of the information in looking, getting ready for this hour and talking to the people in Texas, a lot of what they're trying to do is have the people across different fields, because as things change, you need engineers to work with biologists, you need people from all different fields to work together. Is this part of the issue as well?
Totally. So team science is really where it's at. If you look at where the most important discoveries are being made, they're being made by teams of scientists. So it's interdisciplinary teams. So for us as an institution, for example, we just got a new training award from the Burroughs Wellcome Foundation. And that training award was totally about this idea of training people in teams. And you can only do that if you have all of the component members of that team. So you need, in that case, we need people who know about population health, people who know about wet bench science, people who know how to analyze and interpret data, statisticians who can tell you what that means. There's a huge group of people you need to put that together. And then what you also need is people really who are at the absolute cutting edge. They're using the latest technologies. They've got the latest instrumentation. If you look, for example, at genome sequencing, As many people are very well aware, the cost of sequencing a whole human genome has dropped to now where it's only about $1,000. So a few years ago, that was several hundred million dollars. So the technology there has advanced so rapidly that it's not a question of can we do it, it's a question of what do we do with the information when we get it. That requires a whole new discipline that 10 years ago wasn't really at the forefront as it is now. That information analysis, the data science of genetic information. That's at the heart of precision medicine. It's the heart of really what's going to change, for example, very quickly in cancer care. We're going to want to sequence people's cancer genome to understand how best to treat their individual disease. But you need a special group of people to do that, and you need special people who can tell you what the heck the information means when you get it.
Joe Wiederhorn, can you chime in on team science?
Oh, sure. I mean, team science, as Dr. Dewhurst said, I mean, more and more schools are, the federal government developed this program a number of years ago called the Clinical Translational Science Awards, and those were based on team science, bringing in people from different departments within the university, because one thing leads to another, and unless you have, you may see something, you're looking at something under the microscope, and you think, oh, this is pretty interesting, and sort of file it away, and then you're talking to somebody from a different department, and they're saying, oh, but wait a second, that's exactly what I was trying to find out in looking at something X. I'm sorry, I'm not a scientist, so, but I think that. I think that team science is definitely where the future is going. I do want to say one other thing, though. I'll change the subject back a little bit. We know that investing in these scientists work. We know it because between 2002 and 2008, New York was actually a leader in bringing in star scientists. We had a program then what our funding is trying to reestablish, and that was called the Faculty Development Program. The state invested $38 million, and this goes back to the NIH awards, because that $38 million generated another $251 million in new scientific awards. This isn't the economic piece of it. It's not the clinical trials piece of it. This is just a doctor came here, a faculty member came here. They started to do their research. It started to move in a direction that looked promising, and they were able to get more money to come in and to continue that research and to help other people as they were doing research. So this program works, and another example of that is that the National Bureau of Economic Research did a study in 2014, and it looked at the research output. When you bring in a star researcher, what does that mean for the rest of the lab that they're in? And in a lab, they discovered that when you bring in a star researcher, the lab's productivity goes up 54%. And if you look at new recruits, when they get to bring in new recruits, that brings up the lab's productivity by 68%. So, we're talking about the ability for New York to maintain its status as one of the national and international places to be for doing state-of-the-art research and coming up with new drugs and new therapies. And we're really at the precipice of losing that now.
Dr. Dewhurst, can you talk about that productivity in the laboratory?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Joe's absolutely correct. If you bring in new people, it really enables new kinds of science. And so the example I used before of my colleague Steve Gill, we were able to recruit Steve, and his expertise in microbiome made an enormous difference because his colleagues don't have that knowledge. It's a specialty kind of knowledge. It's a technical skill as well as an intellectual repository of information he has. And so he can talk to a pediatrician, one of my other colleagues, Gloria Preihuber. Gloria is really interested in premature children and their outcomes and how to improve those outcomes. And so for her to be able to talk to somebody like Steve just changes the kind of science she can do. It allows her to do a completely different kind that she wouldn't previously have been able to do. And we're full of examples like that. I have a colleague in computer science, Henry Kautz. So Henry's head of our Data Science Institute. You know, what gets him up in the morning is data. He's a computer guy, so he just loves that stuff. And so for him, one of the things he's been interested in is looking at how diseases are spread. He uses Twitter to look at the spread of diseases like flu. And so for him, what's great is being able to talk to folks in infectious diseases about influenza. But they would never be able to do the kind of work Henry could, nor could Henry do it on his own. So it's bringing in people like that who just make a profound difference in what everybody else is then able to do.
So do you think that you will be having a little bit more luck come the next budget cycle, Joe?
I don't think it's going to be luck. I think it's going to be a lot of hard work educating people and talking to people and getting people's buy-in to the idea that this is really important. I do think that people are beginning to. I mean, we had letters this year. We had a sign-on letter from the Senate. We had one from the Assembly, all in support of this. So I think we just have to keep the drumbeat going, and I do believe that we will be we will be successful because this is the new economy, and it is building on the economy that we already have here.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are running out of time. We need to come up on a break. Thanks for joining us on Connections Healthy Friday. I've been speaking with Dr. Stephen Dewhurst, Vice Dean for Research at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, and Joe Wiederhorn, President of the Associated Medical Schools of New York. I'm Michelle Faust. This is Connections Healthy Friday. If you'd like to join us for the next segment, give us a call, 844-295-8255. Coming up after a quick break, a chat about a new peer-based crisis mental health center here in Rochester. We're back with Connections Healthy Friday on WXXI. I'm Michelle Faust. You can join us over the phone. Give us a call at 844-295-8255. Next month is May. It's Mental Health Month. And in the studio joining us, we've got Sherry Reed Watt, Associate Director of Paul Walk Commons and Affinity Place. She's the Program Manager. And we've got Greg Schoner. He's the President and CEO of East House. Welcome.
Thank you.
So talk to us a little bit about what is Affinity Place, fairly new program. Mm-hmm. Do you want to get started?
Sure. Well, first I'll say what East House is. We've been in the community almost 50 years, and we were started as the first group home in really the second group home in the country and the first group home in New York for people who were coming out of the Rochester Psychiatric Center and needed a safe and affordable place to live in the community. So our origins really are with a bunch of folks, the community leaders in Rochester started the program. And fast forward 50 years later, today we have over 500 people in some type of supported residence across Monroe County. They all have either a mental health or a substance use disorder. And we also have recovery service support services in addition to residential, educational, employment supports, social supports, healthy living supports. We have a diabetes prevention program, for instance. So we have a whole array of programs. We really consider ourselves a recovery community for folks.
So when we're talking about Affinity Place, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, so Affinity Place is a totally peer-run respite house, first of its kind in Western New York. And what I mean by peer-run respite is it's people with lived experience. Either they have a mental illness or an addiction that they are recovering from and living independently, doing well. We hire them back as staff, and they will provide the service for Affinity Place, which will be 24/7 staffing. And it's a crisis respite alternative for people who would normally use psychiatric emergency services at the hospital. It gives them a different experience because they can now come to Affinity Place where it's not a medical model. It's peer-based, and they can talk to people who actually understand what they've been through.
So what is the difference in having this peer-run model as opposed to being in a clinic? What are the benefits?
Well, one of the things that's happened over the years, Michelle, is that there's been a cutback in all types of hospital beds, medical beds and psychiatric beds and substance use beds. And as these cuts have gone, what they found is emergency room visits have skyrocketed. So people get accustomed to going to the emergency room for reasons, many of which the emergency room is not equipped to handle. So part of this is a diversion program to say, hey, you know, if you're in crisis, the emergency room may not be the best place for you. This is a community-based alternative. It's really health-focused. We plan on working with people on their coping skills. So when they do have other crises or stress points, they're able to employ maybe their own wellness plan, or they have other strategies to more effectively deal with their crises.
Now, this, I'm imagining, is a way to save money because this would be a less expensive model than a clinical model.
It is. It probably, a bed in a day in a hospital maybe is $1,000, rough figures. This will probably be a little less than $200. And sometimes opportunities come up because people are trying to save money. But it's also an opportunity for us. We've been talking about a peer-run crisis respite for at least a decade in my memory. And so this is an opportunity presented by really reinvestment money. The state's calling this reinvestment money. So as the psychiatric center in particular downsizes, they're reinvesting some of those funds into community-based programming.
Now, Sherry, what's one of the instigations that makes somebody want to come back and spend time helping other people? And does it have a risk of maybe triggering their own issues that they've had in the past?
Yeah, sure. That's always a risk. I think when you're someone who's been there, and we really, that's a big piece of our training that we do with the staff, is to be aware of when you're being triggered. And it's something called secondary trauma. It's okay if that happens, but really having support of the rest of the staff to be able to kind of work through that.
Yeah. When people are coming in, what does that look like? How do you welcome them in? How do they get referred to you?
So it's all self-referral. And we have what we call a registration line that people call. And we do a brief registration with them over the phone to ask them why they're coming. And really, they just need to identify that they're in some type of psychiatric crisis. And if we feel that they're eligible and there's a bed available, they can come right then and there.
What's a situation where we know that a person would be able to come for a peer situation and wouldn't necessarily need a medical intervention, and then the opposite?
Well, there. I mean, there, I could give you a bunch of different examples, but say someone is just really struggling. They could be working full time. They could be doing fairly well, and then maybe something happened. They got triggered. They're having some symptoms, not feeling well. They could utilize the service and still go to their job. So it's less disruptive than having to go in an inpatient stay when that's maybe not what's needed. So,
Dr. Soner, when we are talking about this situation, is there, I mean, how do we, is this a part of the reason that we need something like this? Because there is less funding for psychiatric intervention. Do we really need to be funding more psychiatric intervention in general?
Yes, we need more money. We need more services. There's estimates across the country that probably about a third of the people who have a diagnosed mental illness actually enter into some form of treatment or support. And with substance use, it's even less. It ranges from 10 to 15%. So we're stretched right now, and we're dealing with probably a quarter of the need there is in the community. So, yes, there's always need for more funds. This is partly a new philosophy of care also. It's not purely driven to save money, although it is a less expensive form of care. But it's almost a revolutionary idea, you know, you think of crisis and people get nervous and they want to go see the doctor and be put in a hospital. And it's just not always the best treatment. Maybe it's the highest level of treatment, but it's not the best treatment. We talk about the best treatment being the lowest level of care that meets a person's need rather than just a high level of care. And it's employing peers to be the helpers. We're not hiring doctors. We're not hiring nurses. Some people get nervous about this because we are also using the word crisis. But I think it's innovative and it's revolutionary, and it's going to catch on. It's caught on in other parts of the country. I was just at a workshop, statewide workshop, and somebody from the state of Washington was talking about how they're just employing more and more peers because they're so good at engaging people in need for service. They're just the engagement is so difficult. And, you know, think about yourself. No offense to certainly the medical profession, but sometimes you go to an office or you go to an appointment or you're in the hospital and, you know, you're one down, you know, to the professional. And I think the peer model is, hey, you know, we're on the same basis here. I know better than you are, and I'm here to help you. And I just think it's turning some ideas of health and care on its head that, you know, if you and I are in crisis sometimes, we say, we need a rest, or I got to take a day off, or I need a trip, or I need some quiet time. And I think this, to some extent, normalizes a crisis for a person who happens to have a mental health diagnosis. I'm not saying there aren't some very serious crises and psychotic episodes and life-threatening episodes. This is not directed for that, but there are many, many situations where a person is in crisis and destabilized that just time away and some time to reflect and some quiet time and the passage of time can do wonders for the individual.
Sherry, you're shaking your head.
Well, I agree with everything Greg is saying, and I think it's really a shift in focus. With the medical model, the focus is on the illness and symptoms, where at the respite house, we're going to focus on the person's strengths, their wellness, what they can do to get better. So many times people only focus on their illness and then that's all they can see and they become the illness when they forget about, you know, 10 years ago, what was your life like before you got sick? What were you passionate about? What, you know, were you doing? And so we try to really have those conversations with people to have them remember that, yes, you have this illness, but you also can recover and have a full life.
Do some people feel more comfortable working with their peers as opposed to a doctor?
Oh, yeah. We hear it all the time, you know, that they feel like there is us in them. And not to say that anyone does that on purpose, but They feel heard. It's with peers, it's more about mutual relationship building, and they feel comfortable because they know that that person, that staff member, knows what they're talking about. They're not just saying, I know what you're talking about, but they've actually been there and experienced it.
Okay. We're going to take a call, and if you'd like to join us over the phone, you can give us a call, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, and we're talking about Affinity Place. It's a new peer model for mental health services. And right now we've got Barbara from Brighton. Barbara.
Greetings. I don't know if folks have done this before, but in regard to your previous guests, I was thinking, why aren't the people who are seeking money to attract doctors and research and all that, why aren't they doing what the politics folks do, where they put out emails to all of us out here who would be more than glad to support this, to and arrange it on the email where we can sign a petition to the New York State politicians, et cetera, encouraging them to pay attention to these folks. You know, it's sort of like a new world media version of lobbying. And I'm sure you'd get a lot of people being willing to do that, not just folks who, you know, are personally affected or have been by whatever research has developed, but those of us who recognize the importance of real science as opposed to the nuttiness that's been going on lately. So I was just wondering if that had ever been thought about or tried.
Well, I'll definitely make sure that a message gets through to our previous guests. Right now, we're talking about mental health, 1-844-295-TALK. So how are we recruiting people? How are people actually learning about Affinity Place and able to make that self-referral?
We are out on the road all of this month, going to different agencies, different providers, and doing presentations on Affinity Place. We have brochures that we'll be going around handing out. And really, word of mouth, many of the people that may utilize this service are hearing about it already and are quite excited about it.
And how many beds do you have? Like, what is this actually going, this location going to look like?
It's, we will have 8 single bedrooms, a few common areas in the house. We're trying to make it like a bed and breakfast, very cozy. Each room will have what we're calling a guest book with some forms in there, some community resources that people can use, you know, your local churches, things to do, just like if you were staying at a hotel or a bed and breakfast. We will have staff doing groups if the guests choose to have those, and it's around coping skills. So there may be yoga, there may be meditation, musical instruments, things that maybe people haven't experienced before, but yet they could utilize as a coping skill. We're also, this is a collaboration with the Mental Health Association, so they will have 2 part-time peers working out of the house that will focus on transitioning people, because this is a 3-to-5-day stay. So
there's also a lot of work. I mean, a lot of it's face-to-face. You know, we've been working for about 3 years around the downsizing of the psychiatric center, and the emergency rooms have been involved in the hospitals. And you know, I think we may get referrals from people showing up in the emergency room, and some of the ER staff diverting them, say, well, this isn't appropriate, so we know this program is out there, and why don't you try this? And I hope we don't present it or see it as one isolated program. It's really a program in our whole community-based system. So as Sherry was talking about a guest book, we want people to know about the Creative Wellness Center over the Mental Health Association or Pharmacy Services at Trillium or, you know, public services at the art museum or whatever it might be, to really help them integrate, find services themselves. The less they need us, you know, in the future, the better. So it really is a community-wide effort and came out of a community-wide needs assessment that prioritized this particular program with the dollars I mentioned that were available.
Now, Greg, Sherry mentioned this transition period. What does that transition look like? How do you make sure that the person is transitioning well and actually have all the support services that they need? Some people are given a referral and never follow up.
Right. Some of the best practices is not just to give a person a referral, but to make the referral and take them to the appointment. I think that's where the MHA Bridgers will come in, where we could say, okay, a lot of folks may have medical conditions. Okay, you got to go see your doctor about your diabetes. We've made the appointment in cooperation with the person, and we're going to take you there. We're not going to give you the referral because 80% of the time the person won't follow through with the referral. So I think it's a little bit more hands-on in terms of, you know, not doing things for people, but helping them to get going and helping them to make that first appointment and get established with a provider, a different provider relationship that they might need.
Now, people are hearing this. Some people may be interested in getting a hold of you, but I would imagine that you've probably already got some people lined up for when you open.
Well, the phone numbers that we have right now won't be active until around May 4th. That's when we're going to open. But if people are interested as far as having us come and do a presentation, I can give that information.
Yeah, there's information on our website, www.easthouse.org, and you can call Easthouse 238-4800 and ask for more information about Affinity Place, and we'd be happy to provide that.
But do you have people already booked for when you do open?
No. Since it's a crisis program, we don't really want to take anything until we're able to serve people. So our target date is the week of May 4th to open. And so we'll structure our call acceptance and reservation acceptance, I guess, with the guest home idea, right around May 4th.
Mm-hmm. Now, medical supervision. There's a doctor who will be able to help out if there is a crisis?
We would certainly have, as I mentioned, strong relationships with the emergency rooms and the hospital. So if we would triage or divert a medically necessary request.
But mostly,
mostly
people who can handle the help from their own peers and get that support, as you were mentioning. Want to thank you guys for coming in. We've been speaking with Sherry Reed Watt, Associate Director of Paul Walk Commons and Affinity Place. She's the program manager. And Greg Schoner, who's the president and CEO of Easthouse. Thank you very
Michelle.
Much.
Thank you.